Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
The day I was born was one of the greatest events in my life. Something told me that I was born to be that change often spoken of. When I stepped into the shoes of past visionaries, it felt invigorating. In the forefront of my mind, the word visionary beamed brightly, and I basked in the brilliance of life. With each passing day, I am given the exclusive opportunity to represent ambition and passion without guilt nor shame. And of those nights I weep, I know that joy comes in the morning. I am the sparkle in the Creator's eye. I am the magic in the dancer's feet. I was born to be great. I am an artist. Today's broadcast is dedicated to the literary works of the great Langston Hughes and James Baldwin, both trailblazers in literary and poetry. Langston Hughes' creative lifespan lasted from February 1st, 1902 to May 22nd, 1967, and Baldwin's from August 2nd, 1924 to December 1st, 1987. Both of these insightful and reflective talents breathed life into some of the most memorable pieces in literary history, and I salute them today. People of the world, I am your host, GD. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. It is Monday, February 24th, 2014, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To say I want to write a book is the first step, and actually writing it is reality. When we talk about reality, we can reference these two talented literary enthusiasts. One hails from Kingston, Jamaica, the other, Brooklyn, New York. Their destined path led them on a lucrative literary path filled with words, sentences, and paragraphs. If writing a book was the next step, then both have taken several leaps, being accomplished authors multiple times. Inspiring, innovative, charismatic, and creative are descriptive words befitting Brooklyn-born and author Anthony Pathfinder's talent. And today they have given us a private access into their extraordinary lives. People of the world, I welcome Brooklyn-born and Anthony Pathfinder to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Fellas, how's life treating you these days?
Oh, man, thank you for having me, first and foremost. Everything has been great so far, you know what I mean? Just hanging in there.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate having us on the show. And so far, so good, you know. It's always a struggle, but it's a good struggle, good busy, you know. And as long as it's moving forward, it's all good. It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's all good. I saw the NAACP Awards, and it's just amazing how far we have come as African-American people. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to start out with formal introductions, and we'll start with Mr. Pathfinder. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your humble beginnings.
Oh, wow, a little bit. All right, I was born in Kingston, Jamaica. Came to the States as a child from way back when, New York City. Matter of fact, I grew up in the Bronx. By my late teens, I had moved to Brooklyn and into college, got a college degree, things like that, and worked in New York City. But writing has always been my ambition, and doing it since I was a child. So after some time, everything just clicked, you know, like they said, you know, the stars were aligned, and it was just something that I had to do, you know. Basically, that's it, you know, single, father of two, and just taking life easy, man. You know, that's it.
Well, with all those books you got out there, I don't know about taking it easy and then topping off with that, you know, being a father. I think that you're an extraordinary human being, and I want to thank you once again for being on the show.
Well, you know what it is, to be honest with you? Those books that you mentioned, when you have a love for the things that you do, it's not a difficult task. It's just a love.
You're absolutely, You're absolutely right. If you love doing it, it doesn't feel like work. And what about you, Mr. Brooklyn? I asked you that same question. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your humble beginnings.
All right. I grew up in a Brownsville section of Brooklyn. With anybody who knows about New York or, you know, the Brooklyn area, that's one of those areas that's, statistically, you don't supposed to come out of there and be something positive, you know. But due to a well foundation of, you know, my parents, you know, we made it out of there. 18, I joined the Marine Corps and did a career in the Marine Corps. And what got me into the writing part, to back up, when I was in high school, I had written a short story, and my English teacher wanted me to put in a statewide essay, and I didn't want to do it in reference to the streets was more, you know, entertaining than me actually wanting to write something and go that route. Fast forward, years later in the Marine Corps, you know, we'd be out in the field and cleaning weapons and everything like that. And, you know, to kill time, I would tell stories. You know, somebody would come up with a topic, and I'd make a story out of that topic. And so one of my friends said, you need to go ahead and try to turn these into books. I mean, they sound real good because people walk in and think it's a real story. And so with that being said, when I write stories, I write realistic things that can happen. And if you was to read it, you may know somebody or you may have experienced some of these stories that I've written, even though they are fiction, but they are realistic fiction. And I met, you know, Pathfinder through at one time a mutual friend, and we clicked and we started talking, and next thing you know, we was collaborating on books as well. You know, we have a major book that's going to be coming out before the year is in, and that's how it goes. You know, starting to meet positive people that's like-minded like you are, and that's how you succeed. And, you know, with that said, I met Donna Ramos. She's another person out of Brooklyn that lives in Sacramento, and we got together and started a series of books called Absorption. We finished the first one, and we're going to release that sometime in April. And we're going that under the title of RBE, which is Ramos Barrington Entertainment. And then with Pathfinder, we're going to go under, we have one called Five Boroughs that's coming out, and that's coming under Firestorm Publications. So, you know, I've just been blessed to be around positive people that's you know, like-minded, and we're trying to do things and, you know, be able to get to the point where we can promote literacy and try to get some of the younger generation and people involved in writing, you know.
Well, I think that both of you are extraordinary individuals. Like I said in the beginning, a lot of people talk about writing a book, but to actually write that very first book and then continue pumping out literary work is just an amazing feat. So I know that both you and Anthony have worked together, and you've done some very remarkable things as far as literary is concerned. And that collaborative effort, what is the most challenging part of a collaborative effort that you have found to be in the forefront, Anthony?
Well, to be honest with you, the main thing for me is depending on the person, because you have to depend on that other person when you collaborate. You know what I mean? Because once you decide to do a collaboration with another author, you know, you both have to basically respect each other and also have that discipline. Because it's not like you're writing your own novel anymore. You know, you have to make sure that your partner is working when he or she says that she's working and when certain things are due. You know what I mean? It has to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it has to be taken seriously. And also, you have to also have what I call compatibleness, because he or she, once you take on that project, it has to flow.
Uh-huh.
It has to be synchronized. You know what I mean? So you have to find someone. You can't just get, you know, you can't just say, well, I'm GED the author, I'm Brooklyn Born the author, and I'm going to collaborate with someone out there that you may have read their work. And even though the works aren't that similar, you'll say, well, you know what, let me see if I can work with this person. And then, boom, you start working on this project. And then once you start getting the chapters and things like that, and you start reading it, and you start seeing that the fluidity is not there, that's a recipe for disaster, you know. So there has to be some kind of compatibleness there as far as you and that other person that you desire to work with. You know what I mean? It has to be there. It has to be that connection. That's how I look at it. But it's always something good, because if someone can work with you and you and that person can put out a project that's well-written, that's well-polished, and the story is there and the fluidity is there and the readers are willing to gravitate towards it and accept it, then that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And you know what, when we talk about writing books, because I'm a 5-time self-published author too, I haven't dove into another novel. I've got several that I've been working on, but you talk about that discipline that has to be there. And, you know, when we're talking about the younger writers out there, the younger generation actually is really into the instant gratification, you know, that comes along with, you know, they think that, you know, I'll write this book, I'll go ahead, it's not edited. You know, it may not have the great, it might even have a great cover, because what I find with a lot of these young writers is the covers are off the hook, and then you open up the book, and there are so many grammatical errors in it, you know, you just really wonder if they are going to learn from, you know, their first efforts, or if they're just going to continue putting just literary garbage out there, you know. And the strange thing about it that I've seen is that a lot of these youngsters have huge followings that people follow them. So with either of you, is there ever some sort of dismay that your novels may not be moving as fast as some of these artists that are not honing their craft?
I'll let Brooklyn take this one and then I'll respond after.
Okay. Go ahead, Brooklyn.
No, to me, it's going to give you longevity. It's just like music. You know, you have some people that's one-hit wonders, or even in the movies, you might see them in a movie once or twice, but then you don't see them anymore. That's what happens when you put out a book that's not really edited that well. And if you happen to put out a book that's not edited that well, you should be able to look at it and get it re-edited and then put it back out. That's where your longevity goes, because people are going to be like, okay, you're going to get the reputation that, oh, this person's book is going to be messed up. And now word of mouth, and nobody's going to start, you know, looking at that. So all your ingredients has to go. It has to be like a chef in the kitchen. You know, you got your meats, you got your vegetables. It all has to blend. It all has to taste just right and cook just right. And that's what you got to do when you write a book. It's not just saying, hey, I'm going to write a book. And once you did it, once you complete it, put it out there. It's still a long process. And when we say edit a book, it's not just one. I listen to a lot of editors and authors that's very successful, and they edit the book, you know, 4, 5, 6 times. They go over it and go over it, and, you know, you still might find one or two, but it's pretty much fine-tuned. So that's one thing an author that's coming in need to know. You know, don't rush it. Don't rush, you know, if you're going to cook some pancakes, you're going to make sure it's brown and it's fluffy. You're not going to go ahead and cook one side, the other side is still mushy, and you're going to put it on your plate. It's not going to happen. It's not going to be good. So you got to complete the thing. And going back to what Pathfinder said in reference to collaborating, the chemistry has to blend. You just don't say, okay, hey, Pathfinder, let's write a book. And okay, and we go ahead and do it. No, we'll come up with a topic, we'll come up with a story, and him and I will talk about it. And as we're talking and we're flowing, that's how you know it's a good chemistry and when you're writing something, because it's supposed to flow. And as we write this book, you should not be able to tell after the edit and everything who wrote what. When you read it, you can't say, oh, Finder wrote that, or Brooklyn. You can't. You shouldn't be able to say that. You should be able to enjoy that storyline and just seamless. You know, that's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, with the talk of pancakes and vegetables, you definitely made me hungry, but I just can't imagine those pancakes, I tell you. But I think it's a beautiful analogy, because if it's something that's made right, then it's definitely going to be delectable, and you're going to want to keep coming back to the same place where you got it from. So this message is for Anthony. How much of the influence, as far as your surroundings, how much of that goes into your books? And let me give you an example. I had written something and I had posted it on Facebook, and then you came to me and you told me that in New York, tennis shoes are called sneakers or something like that. And then, you know, is that what they call? So, I mean, there's a lot of depth and thought that goes into this. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you keep your details genuine?
Okay. Let me explain the former first.
Okay.
When you ask about my surroundings, how it works into how it goes into my work, yeah, 100%, totally. It's my environment, and my environment is what I see, what I hear, what I feel, what I've experienced, what others have experienced. And at the same time, there's also my imagination. And my imagination can take me from point A to point Z. And within that broad spectrum right there, I can create fantasies, sci-fi, and I can interlink it with people actually known, known, and see on a basis. So even though it might be a sci-fi story, or it might be a fantasy, or it might be a horror story, I take real life across, you know, people that I've been exposed enough with, and I just put them in a story. It's 100% my environment. The latter part of the question is that as far as could you repeat the latter part again?
The latter part is genuine, making it genuine. Like the West Coast, we might call tennis shoes, but on the East Coast, they might call them sneakers.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And keeping that genuine voice when you're talking.
Well, see, the thing is, all right, that example, I think a lot of writers, sometimes we tend to think our readership are not, I won't say the word stupid, but sometimes we don't give them enough credit. Because if I'm writing a scene and I mention sneakers, and on the East Coast we say sneakers and they use another term, on the West Coast, we have to be mindful of the fact that our readership can get it as long as the story is flowing and there's a continuity to it. The reader, the person that's reading your book on the West Coast, even though they might see the word tennis shoe or sneakers, rather, on the East Coast, they'll put two and two together. They'll know that, oh, it's tennis shoes, and vice versa. If you're a West Coast writer and you say tennis shoes, someone from the East Coast reading that will say, oh, sneakers. You know what I mean? So we have to give our readership a lot more credit. And as long as you're genuine with your craft and you write as if it's your life. You don't, you know, like I see a lot of authors, they'll say, I met one person and he said to me, oh, so this is like a hobby. You know, you just write for fun. I said, no, I write for fun. I think this is my life, just like how I'm living. I get up in the morning, I do the things that I do. It's my life. Writing is my life. I didn't choose this. This chose me. So, yeah, this is something serious. This is not a hobby. So, basically, that's it.
Right, right. Well, one thing that I can honestly say is that when we're talking about quality and excellence, I definitely see both of you there as well. And we started off networking on Facebook, and we've actually become pretty good friends over the last few years. And I think that your combined ambitious is very infectious, because I really am inspired by you and a few others out there, because you stayed steadfast on the path. You know, it wasn't that we were talking about books a few years ago, and now you're off into trying to sing. You know, you've been very dedicated to the craft. So the question that I have, and I'll ask this question to both of you, Anthony, where does your creative drive come from?
Oh, wow. Simple. It comes from me just being the person that I am. You know what I mean? I'm an optimist, and every task that I take up, I always try to give it 100%. And my creative drive comes from the desire of always being an un. Growing up, I grew up in the South Bronx. I lived in Bedford-Stuyvesant. I lived in Flatbush. I lived in Brown Heights. And for anyone who's from New York City, they know those neighborhoods, like Brooklyn, it's about his own Brooklyn neighborhood, is that sometimes you're not supposed to get out of there. You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of, I'll just say violence, you know. It's just unsettled, you know. And right. once you go through these things, you become an underdog. So for me, it's that drive to be better. You know what I mean? It's that drive to get out, you know. I put that in my writing. Everything that I do, every novel that I've written so far, it takes me back where I wasn't supposed to get to point A. That's what drives me. The voices that told me that you can't, you will not, it will never happen. Those voices from people who were around me, things like that, those things drive my creative juice, yeah.
All right, all right. And so, Brooklyn, what about you? What keeps your creative mojo intact?
Well, what gets me going is what I see out there as far as in Hollywood, per se, like the movies that's out there. We got RoboCop is coming back out, and they didn't even come up with a new name, just RoboCop. I mean, when it first came out, what was it, 70s, 80s or something like the 80s, I think? And now
right.
Here it is. 14 and coming out with RoboCop again. It don't say 1, 2, 4, 5. It's just RoboCop. So I look at stuff that keeps me going. It's something that I know I can put out, I believe, better. I believe that stories are realistic. It's fresh. And if Hollywood would recognize some of us independent authors and really give us a chance to check out our work, they have abundance of new material that they can put on the screen that would make money and people will enjoy. You know, I see a lot of movies and I go and I was like, that was a good one, or the ending could have been better, you know. And I know some of it deals with budget and everything, but you, as the author or the creator of that work, have some say-so, you know. Like Shonda, when she put out, you know, Scandal and, you know, Grey's Anatomy, she has a lot of say-so, and that's why her movies or television shows are very successful. You know, it's good. It captures you. And it's a lot of us out here that have that same inspiration and quality and talent. So I just, that's my drive. That keeps me going. And being that, you know, I done, you and Pathfinder know, you know, I done traveled the world, and it's a lot of things that I see, and I keep it realistic. To go back what Anthony was saying, I mean, what you had asked Pathfinder about,
in reference to East Coast and West Coast, some things that I experienced in life, I put it in the book. When I went out there in 2010, the first time I went out there to do a signing, my sponsor, they took me out to dinner and everything, and it was funny because they mentioned something about cupcaking. And it was like E.F. Hutton. I said, cupcaking. What is cupcaking? Everybody looked like that whole restaurant looked like it got silent and looked at me. I said, and I got offended, but it was a funny offense. I said, look, I ain't never heard that. What is it? And they told me, right? So I was like, oh, okay. So, and then another one is what your West Coast use is like, it's hella hot, it's hella cold, it's hella crazy.
Right, so
I make those notes, and that one movie that was made with the young brother that was killed, Fruitvale.
Fruitvale Station, yeah.
And he was saying hell, and I was like, okay, you know, I'm relating to all of it because I was there and everything. So when I write something, it's more like research, and you put those in it. And when what Anthony was saying in reference to tennis shoes and sneakers, if I can, I will give a definition. I might write a scene where the guy may say, I put on my sneakers, and the guy was like, what sneakers? He said, well, we call them sneakers here in New York. Out in California, you know, I might put a California guy, and he said, out there, or in D.C., because D.C. says it too, tennis shoes, you know. So people, the readers, I try to make it as easy as possible, so good, easy reading, because I'm not trying to get somebody with a Ph.D. to read my work. I want the common person to read my work and enjoy it. So that's what I'm at.
Say that, why don't you? I just love talking to you guys. You really do have an insight and a love and a care and a respect for the craft. Something that you mentioned about Shonda. One thing, because I've been going to the movies a lot and I find myself studying them a lot more, I got a chance to see the movie Nebraska. It was a black and white movie. It was about an aging father who thought he had won Publishers Clearinghouse. You know how they send those in the mail, you could possibly win? So the son, you know, to spend more time with his father who was very much, you know, close to his time here on Earth. And, you know, I got the feeling where the writer of that wanted to delve into a theme that deals with dealing with aging parents and, you know, just how funny they are. And then I saw another one that was about this Indian guy, and I can't think of the name of this movie, but he wanted to see the world, and so he went from India to a place in Africa where there was a single train station, and he was there kind of like, I don't know, somebody that was there to look after that train station. It was out in the middle of nowhere. And the very first night that he got there, this damn lion started chasing him, you know. So I hear where you're coming from with that, Brooklyn. I tell you, you know, the RoboCop, you know, Carrie, they remake Carrie. Steve, it's like how many more times can you keep remaking the same thing and hold our interest? So I applaud both of you for stepping out and wanting to tell a different story. And since we're talking about telling different stories, I want to get your perspective on the Slave movies. 12 Years a Slave, Driving Mrs. Daisy, you know, The Help. You know, I don't know about you, but it's like, okay, how many more stories do I have to see where we are maids or butlers or getting beat on our back? I mean, do you think that we've come far enough to probably, okay, let that rest as far as filmmaking is concerned, or do you think that it is necessary storytelling?
Well, I think that, you know, we do have astronauts. We do, you know, have African-American astronauts. We do have people in other fields. And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the history part. But, you know, let's go ahead and look at some other things and make those movies about, you know, because we want the kids not to just go play sports and, you know, things like that. We want to know that we contribute in many ways. You know, I want to see more movies of, you know, the African-Americans that built the traffic light that built, that made plasma, you know, that went into space, things like that. I mean, if you can do Sandra Bullock in this thing about Earth, space, I want to know about the journey of the first black woman astronaut, the first black astronaut, you know, their road, things like that. If you want to go in history, let's go with a lot of history that we had made. I mean, refrigerator cars for on a train and things like that. There's a lot that we had contribute. Let's make some movies about that as well. You know, let's do that.
Yeah, I agree with you.
The 12 Years a Slave was a good story because I do know about people that was free. You heard it before. People that was free that was taken into slavery, especially down in the South. You know, and you know it gets your blood boiling a little bit, but I want to give some more educational stuff about, you know, those other people that contribute. You know, I understand about, like, say, Martin Luther King and Malcolm and everything like that, but there's also some other civil rights leaders that was out there in the forefront that we don't know about. I want to know about them as well. You know, good or bad, Rosa Parks, you know, we know about Rosa Parks. But I can't remember this lady's name, but Rosa Parks wasn't the first lady. It was another lady that was arrested because she didn't want to move. She was tired. But because she had a record, they did not put her up there to, you know, to be the NAACP,
exactly,
you know, face. So these are the people I want to know about, okay? Because somebody might have did something and they did some time, it's done, they did their time, that's fine. But if they did, and they did something like that lady did, that should be said. There was another gentleman, James Earl Jones played him, a pastor, and it was at some southern church, and they got rid of him because he was outspoken. And then they oust him out, and then the next person they got was actually Martin Luther King. I want to know about that other guy. You know, they got one story about now James Earl Jones playing him, and it's, you know, they play it every so many years. Those are the things. That's why I like to write certain things to bring to the forefront as well. And like Pathfinder said, you know, the sci-fi. We got something coming out called Absorption. Donna Ramos and myself, it's going to be a four-book series. And it's a sci-fi futuristic that nobody has ever seen before on the screen. And I know for a fact, and I'm not just saying it because I assisted in writing it, but I know that people would love reading it and people would love to go watch it. So just keep things fresh, you know. Be, how could I say, an innovator. You know, don't be a follower. And that's what they're doing. They're spending all this money on these following movies. Get some of us indies out there. Get us out there, and we can make it happen.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah,
go ahead, Anthony.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree with my brother from another mother to a certain degree, but I tend to think that we need more movies like that because it's a legacy, it's our history, and our young people need to know these things. I mean, sure, you know, Brooklyn, he spoke about, you know, black astronauts and all these black innovators who invented certain things. Yes, I'm in total agreement with knowing about these people and making movies about these historical people as far as the civil rights movement is concerned, et cetera, et cetera. However, we do need more movies like this. One, I'll tell you why. How many of us read about an individual like Mr. Northrop, I think that's the name, okay? I've read stories of blacks who were freed blacks during the period who were sold into slavery. But to actually hear this, to actually see the story of this particular individual and even the butler, to see that other side, some folks may say, well, he was Uncle Tom, you know. However, given the period and what he endured and the things that he went through, I think we need more movies like this to show how some of us and the things we had to experience in order to make things better for a lot of us. Because let's not forget that the White House was built on the backs of gays. It was their blood, sweat, and tears that built the White House.
That's
and
true.
To see this man who did so much as a in the White House, I'm not saying that we need to see the Stephen Fitch, characters where, but we need stories like that because not all of us are writers. Not all of us are singers. So we have to show both sides. So I think we need more movies so our young people can see these things. So what? It's slavery. Wake up. You know what I mean? Wake up. You don't see any other group or groups talking about, well, we don't want to see anything else on the Holocaust. We don't want to see anything on the Chinese Revolution. No. They want their stories told. So let's continue doing those projects. And I have no problem with it. None.
And I could see the good in both sides of that. And that's exactly why I'm glad that you both took a stab at it so that we could go ahead and get both perspectives out, because I believe that it is a combination of both, and I believe that the importance comes from how the story is told and what the message is that's being conveyed. Because, you know, I remember, thanks for bringing up the movie The Butler. Oh, my God, that was such a powerful story, especially now since we have President Obama in office. So you see this guy going through all of these white presidents, and here we are now. And I actually, it was definitely a tearjerker, and I just believe that, you know, as long as there's a diversity out there, then I'm pretty sure that I'll be okay with it. So, you know, I watched the 45th NAACP Awards, like I mentioned earlier on, and I saw it on Saturday. The very first thing, I was just so honored to see so many African-American people and people of color from different countries convene, and there were also, you know, white people there because, again, you know, I am about diversity in life. And so to see a representation there, it tells us just how far we have come in the fight for equality for all people. So I discovered that there were categories for literary contributions of writers. I had Stanley Bennett Clay on a couple of weeks ago, and he has been in the industry for a while. I didn't even know that he was actually on Good Times and some of the sitcoms that, and I can't remember that writer's name, but he was very popular in the day. He had Maude, he had the Jeffersons, and so I found out that he had won like 3 NAACP Theater Awards. So when we're talking about literary contributions of writers, as a writer, Brooklyn, how do you define success?
How do I define the last? Sorry for the last part. Say the last part.
Okay. How would you define success being a writer?
Well, as far as me writing, success would be completing a story that I said that I was going to write. I take it at the lowest level. That makes me happy. Everything above that is gravy. If I get an award, that's fine. If I don't, it's fine. It's completing the project. That's what I consider success. The sub line to that is when somebody reads your work and enjoy it as well or as much as when you were writing it, that's success.
Mm-hmm.
If I write something in there and, you know, it's a tearjerker and I feel it inside me and I was able to portray it in words and see the emotions on somebody who don't know me cry for something I read, that's success.
Mm. Interesting. And what about you, Anthony?
Oh, I think success is an endless journey, bro. You know what I mean? I think to add to what Brooklyn said, it's starting a project, whatever it is, however small, however large or big it may be, and completing that task. So for me, it's a journey. reach. You know what I mean? Success is something, is something that when you start out, that's the ultimate goal. That's the ultimate goal, to be successful in whatever it is that you're doing. You know what I mean? And once you complete that task, the joy, the fulfillment of knowing that you completed it, that to me says it all. Yeah.
Okay. And have either of you, with that in mind, have either of you ever experienced a critique that was less than what you hoped it would be? And if you have, how did you handle it? I told you I'm getting better.
GD, you should know this. Okay, Brooklyn knows it. And every author, every writer,
uh-huh,
every singer, every rap artist, they all know that once you're in any kind of business like this, okay,
uh-huh,
the critiques and the criticisms will come at you. And the thing that you have to do is not take it to heart. You just look at it and you say, oh, well, not everybody's going to like every story that I write. But you know what? I'm thankful for those who like it. So the critique that I'm getting, if I thought my book was supposed to be 5 stars and I got 3 stars, yeah, I'll say, well, we know that that reviewer doesn't know anything about writing or a story or anything like that. But,
mm-hmm,
but whatever he says, I'll just overlook it in the sense that if it's not something that will define my writing, if it's just a diatribe of negative insults, et cetera, and I can't find nothing in what he or she says that will help to define my writing and make me a better writer, I just move on. Nothing. It's nothing to it. You know, so you have to have a hard, you have to have a hard shell in this business, a hard backbone. You have to have a spine, a backbone. You know what I mean? You can't be passive in this business and take everything for what it is when it comes to criticisms or critiques from reviewers. And by the way, I do review for the Urban Book Source, so I kind of like know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. I wanted to ask questions that would, you know, if somebody is listening, to, you know, give them some type of a push, because, you know, we are in a business of where it's amazing that a lot of us are sensitive, you know, as far as creativity,
mm-hmm,
and self-expression goes. But, you know, when you're putting it out there, you certainly don't, you certainly hope that it's going to get glowing reviews, but, you know, even the best have had. Yeah, even the best have had their negative reviews on that.
You're right. And you see, you know, like Pathfinder said, if it's some type of criticism that can improve your writing or your storytelling or some, or your storyline, then you take it and you work on your next project and incorporate that. But if it's something that's malicious, you know, you just let it go. You know, just like Crest, 4 out of 5 dentists like it, right? So the one that don't like it, okay, but 4 likes it, let's keep it moving. And that's
it,
you know.
I dig
your fans,
that analogy.
The fans will, you know, your fans is going to tell you how your work is, you know. And I've been blessed enough to people that don't read. I write, and I know Pat and I talked about it, and also Donna, I write for people who don't read, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I don't write for, now keep in mind, do not get this confused with people who can't read. I say people who don't read,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Right.
They're tired of certain types of books, so
mm-hmm,
they don't read anymore. I like to write for those people because I have those people that have came to me and said, you know what? I haven't read a book in such and such, but I really like your story. I like your storyline. That's what I'm talking about, you know. So long as they like it and I'm writing for them, that works. Like you know, Taft said, everybody's not going to like your work, you know. And if I don't like something, you know, I would say, you know, I don't like it because I don't eat like fish. I don't like fish, so I don't eat fish.
You know, you don't like
it
fish.
It looks good, you know, but it looks good and smells good. You know, that's how I am. I don't like it, but it smells good and it looks good. So when somebody critique yourself, they, you know, when somebody critique you, they should give you both. If they're going to go on a left and say, this is bad, this is bad, this is no good, this is no good, then they should tell you what's good about it, okay? But if they all the way to the left and not telling you something, then, you know, let it go. If it's all the way to the right, don't get your head big that everything you write is going to be great, you know? Right. If something that you got that's good, make sure you brand it, make sure you work on it, make sure you practice it, and make sure you keep it fresh. Because it ain't what you did yesterday, it's what you did today, your next book, your next story. And that's why a lot of sequels fail. Okay, they write a book, is it good? They write the next book, and they're like, what the heck is this mess? No. So keep all that.
Yeah, you know what, when I think of different genres that and definitely the point definitely well understood. So and because, you know, the ones that are like that and you take it with a grain of salt, there are a lot of haters out there. They don't, you know, that's just in them. They have something negative to say about everybody. And so you really do have to have a thick skin and take it with a grain of salt. So when we're talking about the different types of stories that there are to tell about us, I like the idea of us being in sci-fi. I know that Forrest Whitaker has a movie. I can't think of the name of it. It's coming out, and he's playing like the character book. And and I can't think of the name of that dang old movie to save my life, but I know that I really do like diversity. Like, I loved Eve's Bayou. That was one with Lynn Whitfield and Samuel Jackson. I just loved that movie so much because it was so different. But then at the same time, I did love Best Man Holiday because I liked the idea that we were writers. Well, you know, one was a football player, but then you had another one, the Terrence Howard character, that was complex because he was a very, even though he's arrogant, because he is in a lot of his parts, but I just love the storyline of a friendship. And, you know, when I walked away from that, it made me feel stronger about the quality of friendships that you have in life. So this gift of writing is truly a divine force of self-expression. And
yes,
so when we're talking about genres, how do you jump from one type of genre into another specific thing, Brooklyn?
I look at it as life. You know, life, that's just life. We don't live just one way in life. I mean, we come in with different facets. You know, you have your good days, your bad days. You meet good people, you meet bad people. You eat good food, you have bad food. I mean, that's just life. It gives you, you know, you've been in love before. You can write about romance. You know, you've been in a scary situation. You can write an action suspense. You know, you just got to sit down, dig in, look at your life or look at movies that you like and work with that, and you'd be able to write different genres. You know, like Pathfinder and myself, and like I keep saying, Donna as well, Donna Ramos, we are not in a box. You cannot, and that's just like, what you call it, these characters it's escaping me now, but, you know, you see this certain guy, and all he can do is play a bad guy, you know, or
exactly.
Or this guy can only be a comedian, you know. You cannot put us in that box because we will write period pieces, you know, we can write romance, we can write action, suspense, mystery, we can write sci-fi, you know, and out of that, a few of us get in there and write children books. So that's your diversity. You know, and if you have that, that's another means of, to me, of success as well. I mean, some people make a lot of money being in one genre and all, or that's what they like, but I do not want to be categorized as one genre. I want to be, you know, when you come and read my books, you know you're going to read something good, and it's going to be for everybody, like we say, do the sci-fi. We could, you know, I'm working on another piece. It's a short story, though, and it deals with in the slave era, but at the same time, it's not dealing with slavery. So, you know, when you have that diversity, you can make something like that, but put your own spin on it.
Right, right. There was a study that I had on his name is Stephen Van Patten. He wrote the series Brookwater's Curse, and, of course, it's about black vampires. So I know that we, you know, back in the day, you know, Scream, Blackula Scream, and then, you know, we had Eddie Murphy with his, you know, Vampire in Brooklyn. But this guy's book, you know, as a matter of fact, as a result of being on this show, he inked a development deal with Iron Violet Pictures. And I was like, whoa, that is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So so I really believe that, you know, the more diverse we show ourselves, the better it feeds to a public that is hungry. And when we stay true to what it is, you know, then the right people are going to actually follow us. So what I want to talk about is the latest literary contributions. But before I continue, somebody has a question?
Yeah. I just wanted to add to what Brooklyn was saying. I'll just simplify it. Simply put, I'm a writer. I'm a writer first. I write, pigeonhole myself.
Right.
Okay? When you're a writer, you write. When you're an author, you tend to stick to a particular genre. When you are a writer, you write, because that's what you do. Okay? Now, you have some folks, okay, who would like to write in other genres. However, their command of the English language is not like others. So that becomes a setback for them. Because like Brooklyn says, Brooklyn is working on Absorption. That's a sci-fi. I am working on The Singing Eyes. That's a sci-fi. I have done New Blood. That's a vampire saga.
Right.
Okay? I'm now working on Treasure, which is about three sisters from a family who passed as white. The family passed as white for generations until the oldest sister found out that they were actually black. And it's based on true facts because the story takes place during the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and I ended in the 60s. Okay? So it's almost completed. So what I'm saying is, and I've also written street fiction, street lit. Okay, so what I'm saying is that if you're a writer, you write. You just write. You know what I mean? I've also written articles on breast cancer, things like that, obesity. So my thing is just write. If you're a writer, just write. When you become an author and you just say that you're an author, you tend to pigeonhole yourself. That's all I wanted to add.
True.
Well, you know what? I think you brought up a very excellent point, and I'm so glad that we have it recorded so that people can actually listen because I definitely do see the differentiation between an author and a writer. And let's face it, you know, life inside a box, I can honestly say, is definitely not a place for me. And I guess that's what I really loved about you and Brooklyn is because you aren't afraid to stretch your wings and step into other territories that other people may not, you know. And this vampire thing is a very lucrative type of creative venture as well. So the question I have is every writer wants to write the great novel. So I want both of you guys to have your say at this. So let's go ahead and start with you, Brooklyn. Have you written your great novel yet?
No, because I'm not dead yet. So I haven't written the greatest novel yet, but up to date, the one that I think that's up to date would be The Right Lover. That's the one that I would love to see on the silver screen because it has a plethora of emotions and it will definitely take you on a roller coaster ride. And that's as of to date, that would be the one that I really, really like to see, you know, on a leading the rest of the books. But no, I haven't written the greatest one yet.
All right. And what about you, Anthony?
I tend to agree. I haven't yet, but Treasure, I feel very, very good about it. I'm not saying it is, but I feel very good about it because it's near and dear to my heart. It's something that I've always wanted to write about because when I was in school, when I was in college, I was an African studies major, okay, in African studies. And I've always wanted to take a story where our peoples, basically the ones who passed for white after the Civil War, leading into the first half of the 20th century, I've always wanted to write a story with a family who went through a lot and experienced the Jim Crow era. And for me, it's like I've taken everything from my classes, from the documentaries that I've seen on television, the Martin Luther's, the Malcolm X's, et cetera, and I've just combined it with this love story with my main character, where she actually falls in love with a brother, and the brother doesn't know that she's a sister, and she's holding on to it, and she's in a dilemma because she doesn't know how to go about telling them that she's actually black because she has lived her life, most of her life, as a white girl. And here he is, and this is in the South, and they have to keep their love affair a secret. So it's something that I feel really, really good about, and it's the longest. I've been writing this for a long time now, so I feel good about it. I think the longer that you stay on a project, I think the end result is usually much better. So I'm kind of looking forward to this, yeah.
Okay, that sounds fantastic. And, again, for the listeners who have tuned in today and who will be listening to the recorded broadcast, we are speaking to two extraordinary talented people in literary, and that is Anthony Pathfinder as well as Brooklyn Bourne, both out of New York. They have a plethora of works out there on the market right now, and we're going to when I come back, because I'm going to go ahead and take a break for just a moment to talk about some of the guests coming up later this week. I want to go back so that we can find out where their books can be purchased. So give me a minute, fellas, for just a second. So later this week on the show, we have two extraordinary men in entertainment that will be joining me on A Touch of Grace. One returns for part two of an earlier interview, and that'll be this Thursday, 2/27. He's a television producer at BET. He's interviewed some of the likes of Tina Turner, Natalie Cole, Chaka Khan. He's also a minister and an empowerment coach, and that's what we're going to be talking about during this particular interview. His name is Kevin E. Taylor, and the other is the phenomenal stage performer, Darius D. Haas, whose powerful voice has been part of some amazing stage plays on Broadway, from Kiss of a Spider Woman to the Tony-winning play Dreamgirls. And I love the duet that he sings, Just Friends, with Vanessa. As a matter of fact, that's how I found him when I was doing some searching on YouTube. So I'm very excited about these energies that will be coming to the show later this week. Now, back to the powerful energies that we have now. So the first question that I want to ask both of you, where can your books be purchased?
Okay. You want to go first, Brooklyn? Go ahead.
Okay. Yes. It could be purchased on Amazon.com. It also could be purchased on my website at www.authorbrooklynborn.com, which is Brooklyn is spelled B-R-O-O-K-L-E-N, and Born is B-O-R-N-E. You can purchase it on those sites.
Yeah, you can get mine at Amazon.com and also at AnthonyPathfinder.tumblr.com and also AnthonyPathfinder.wix.com.
All right, thank you both. So for the final inspirational message, I would like both of you to take a time to kind of talk to the inspired person that might be listening. What inspirational message would you like to leave listeners with today, Brooklyn?
if you have an idea and you want to write it, write it. Many people are going to tell you certain things that will discourage you, but stay on track. Stay true to what you want to do and write that story that's inside you. And do, as my motto say, bringing thoughts to life. They're your thoughts. Bring it to life on paper. And you may be just that one that will be seen in the movies. People will be lining up to see your movie, your story in a movie form. Continue to write.
Thank you, Brooklyn. And how about you, Anthony?
You know, what I like to share with others is just to tell them this phrase, believe not because some old manuscripts are produced. Believe not because it is your national belief. Believe not because you have been made to believe from your childhood. But reason truth out. And after you have analyzed it, then if you find it will do good to one and all, believe it, live up to it, and let others to live up to it. That's what I'll leave with everybody. Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for being guests on the show. I certainly love your spirit. I love what you're doing out there. And definitely, as the months progress, you know, I'll have you back on the show to discuss where you are in your literary path. So today I'd like to leave you with a thought. If your life is at a standstill, if you have surrounded yourself with negative energy and pessimistic spirits, then you have an important decision to make. You can love unconditionally, and I believe the higher power smiles on that. But I also believe in the old saying that my dear grandmother Lil, may she rest in peace, used to say, you got to treat them with long-handled spoons. You see, we are given but one life, and we are expected to be a living testimony of the beauty of this existence. Some are filled with bitterness and jealousy, and they can't see beyond their own misery. It doesn't make them bad people. It just makes them bad company to be around. Make a decision about how you want to live your days, and don't be afraid to shine. This is GD wishing you a touch of grace. All right. It's a wrap.